Shrink Wrap Radio number 327, Politics and Jung, with Jungian analyst Tom Elsner.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today, Tom Elsner, J.D., M.A., Jungian analyst, is a core faculty member at Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara, California, where he also has a private practice. A former attorney, he trained at the Jung von Franz Center for Depth Psychology in Zurich. A member of the C.G. Jung Study Center of Southern California, his areas of special interest include alchemy and the depth psychology of folklore and literature. He's currently completing a book about Coleridge and the rhyme of the ancient mariner. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Tom Elsner, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on the show again. People really loved our last interview on fairy tales. I got a lot of emails about that.
Oh, well, that's great. Yeah, thanks very much. That was a fun interview for me.
I'm glad, and hopefully we'll have another fun one here today. Yeah. We're going to be talking about Jung and politics, but we're not going to be talking about our personal political opinions. We just went through an election, and there'd be a lot of emotions around all of that. There were then, there are now, I imagine. But as you pointed out in an email to me, that we should sort of be influenced by Einstein's observation that the significant problems we face today cannot be solved at the same level of thinking that created them.
Right.
So we're going to rise one level above, one or more levels above the current conflicts. Most of us don't think about Jung and politics in the same frame, but you've pointed out that Jung was deeply engaged psychically with the events preceding the First World War. So maybe you can tell us about that and something about the series of dreams that he had at that time.
Sure. Well, just to start with what you were talking about in terms of political discussions, you know, these are the things that you don't talk about, right, at polite dinner conversations or religion. And the reason being, obviously, that these discussions constellate our deepest held values. They constellate emotional reactions, truths, certainties, just like religion does. So you want to walk into this discussion within the framework that you constructed, which is definitely that we are not going to be talking about which is the right political opinion or not, and I'm certainly not going to be sharing with you my own personal viewpoints on politics, which wouldn't be very interesting in any event. But hopefully we can try to look at the ways in which Jung was interested in politics and the ways in which this might help us lead, jump up to a new level of awareness and consciousness about these political problems.
Yeah, let me just jump in and piggyback on your observation that we're reluctant to talk about these things. I just recently listened to an episode on This American Life where they explored how absolutely divided this country was in this recent election to the point of families breaking up and long friendships being dissolved, real animosity and shock that the other could embrace their horrible, destructive political position. Mm. So I'm sure you'll be getting into, talking about the shadow and so on in that. But back to Jung's dreams foreshadowing the First World War.
Yeah, Jung does come under criticism typically for being concerned with the individual and not very concerned with the collective, not very concerned with society or political issues. You know, in the sense of we've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world's getting worse. What's the relevance of psychology to world political problems? Not many people know that, with the publication of Jung's Red Book in 2009, and I know you've had Nancy Ferlotti on your show talking about the Red Book, that whole experience of Jung of getting so deeply involved with his visions and dreams and encounters with the unconscious, active imagination. It all came out of dreams and visions that he was having prior to the outbreak of World War I. So, for instance, in October of 1913, Jung experienced a vision of a flood that covered all of Europe from England to Russia, and this vision lasted 2 hours. He had other visions in which there was a sea of blood covering over all these lands. Other dreams in 1914 of being in a foreign land, and suddenly a terrible cold descended from space. So these dreams and visions he was having around that time were really apocalyptic and horrifying.
And you mentioned that that initial vision lasted 2 hours. You know, and I knew that he had had, quotes, a dream, but 2 hours, that's really something. I don't think I've ever had a 2-hour dream or vision or anything close to that.
Really, I have not either. So, you know, thank you for highlighting the uniqueness of that. And then, you know, Jung by this time was already a psychiatrist who had built a worldwide reputation working with schizophrenics. So it wasn't lost on him what might be taking place within himself. Namely, he thought that he was, in those days they called it doing a schizophrenia. He thought that these dreams and visions were prefiguring a psychotic break in himself. He was, for instance, right before the outbreak of World War I, he was in Scotland giving a lecture at a psychiatric congress on schizophrenia. And in an interview in the 50s with Mircea Eliade, he said, "I was certain that I would be speaking about myself and probably go mad right after the lecture."
Amazing.
So he also...
That took courage. I would say that took some courage.
To go into the material.
Well, yeah, not...
You really get the sense of him being on the edge with these...
Well, not only going into the material certainly took a lot of courage, but also getting up before a distinguished audience and announcing that you may be going crazy.
Oh, yeah. Well, he did not say that to his audience in the lecture, but later in the 50s in an interview, he told that to Mircea Eliade and said, internally to himself, Jung was thinking, probably I'll be speaking about myself and I'll probably go mad right after the lecture.
Okay.
But that was right before the outbreak of World War I. Jung, in that same interview in the 50s, recounts how he says when he was in Scotland and the news of the war broke out, he had to take the fastest ship possible back home to Switzerland, just as he had dreamt. He had had that experience in a dream as well. And he said nobody was happier about the outbreak of the war than me. Namely, because now I knew that these visions and dreams did not presage a schizophrenic break in myself, but were, you know, related to the undercurrents of what was happening in the culture and what was happening in Europe and what was happening in terms of the war breaking out. This made a deep, deep impression on Jung about the reality of the collective unconscious, and it gave him courage, because right after this event in World War I was when Jung really started to work on the Red Book. It gave him courage to go into his unconscious, to spend time with it, to express what it was saying, and to work with it, because he was convinced after these experiences around World War I that his unconscious wasn't just his. It was something real that was in the culture. So for me, I really see all of Jungian psychology as we know it being a response to political and social collective events.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, in fact, there you're seeing a far more political thread running through Jung's thought than we've previously been aware of.
I think that's right. And with the publication of the Red Book recently, I think we can really see that. And Soni Shamdasani, in his introduction to the Red Book, talks about this as well.
Yes. Now, I think I cut you off before you actually got to say something about the content of that initial vision that presaged the outbreak of World War I. And probably many people will be familiar with that already, but maybe you could just briefly recapitulate that.
Sure. Well, the series of dreams and visions involved, for instance, a flood that covered all of Europe. Another vision in which Jung saw a sea of blood covering these same lands, a terrible cold descending from outer space and freezing all of Europe. And in that dream, he was in the dream in a remote English land, he said, and had to come back by the fastest ship possible. And the ice in that dream had turned the leaves of a tree into sweet grapes that were full of healing juices, and he was giving those grapes to a crowd of people in the dream. So those were the basic dreams and visions that he was experiencing.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So what are we to make of all this?
Well, I think the basic point that we can make of all this is to consider the possibility today that the so-called inner life, the world of psychology, you know, our own dreams, our own visions, the way that our own inner nature is responding to our contemporary world political problems, there might be some relevance to those so-called inner events, to the outer collective reality. This is what Jung was really interested in, and also what I'm interested in. What is the response of our inner nature today to political turmoil, to war, you know, to these problems of overpopulation, the ecological crisis, problems that if you look at them rationally and intellectually only, they have no solution. What happens then? How does our inner nature respond? So I think for me that's the crux of it.
Yeah, and that's a very good question. And you, in a paper that you sent me, you start off proposing a number of questions, and I'll probably end up restating them to you. And the first one was really what you just said: how might a depth psychology that takes account of Jung's idea of the collective unconscious be relevant to our contemporary socio-political problems?
Yeah.
And of course, one place that we see this on the world stage today, for example, is Iran and the U.S. What might a Jungian perspective offer us as we are all nervous and thinking about that?
Yeah, thank you for phrasing it like that. For me, there's a couple main points there that Jungian psychology can offer. One is Jung's concept of shadow projection.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is the idea of thinking symbolically or metaphorically about religious and political events.
Well, let's take those two separately and tell us a bit about shadow projections and their role.
Sure. The word Jung came up with as shadow is it's a metaphor for what we don't see about ourselves. So the psychological rule is that there are contents that belong to all of us, aspects of our own psychology and personality and self, that for whatever reasons are incompatible with our conscious perspective. They're incompatible with our idealized image of ourselves, or they're incompatible with what society says we should be like. And typically what happens to those qualities about the self is that they are repressed. And if psychological qualities are repressed, they don't go away. What happens instead is that they're inevitably projected out and seen in other people. So this is what Jung referred to as shadow projection, the phenomenon of seeing what is disliked, rejected, repressed, banished in our own psychology in someone else and fighting against it out there. So, you know, personally, I'm sure all of your listeners and you and I know can think of probably a few examples, at least right off the top of our heads, of how this affects us in our personal lives. On the world political stage, these shadow projections can take archetypal or mythological forms. For instance, evil, the phrase an axis of evil, locating absolute evil in the others that live across the ocean. So this, you know, Ronald Reagan referred to the Soviet Union as an evil empire. George Bush, in the State of the Union address that he gave, referred to an axis of evil that consists of Iran, North Korea, and Iraq. On the other side, the Ayatollah Khomeini is quoted as saying, for instance, that the United States is the great Satan. And Iran and Iraq responded to George Bush's statements by saying, well, the real axis of evil is the United States, Great Britain, And they listed another country that I can't recall off the top of my head. And Russia was a lesser Satan. Hugo Chavez, you know, speaking at the United Nations after George Bush took the stage, he said, the devil spoke here yesterday, and you can still smell the sulfur on the podium from George Bush. You know, so we get the vivid experience that, and this is why politics, I think, is so emotionally gripping. It's because it touches our deepest fears and highest values. And this can get expressed sometimes in terms of mythological ideas about evil.
And it's interesting how consistent those projections are from both sides. The examples that you gave are, you know, the archetypal devil. And both sides are evoking that image.
Mm. And this is nothing new. I mean, right, this has happened, it seems like, throughout world history and on various levels. And the people across the river are always the bad people, you know. And if we could just find a way to eliminate them, everything would be fine.
And I also think, I also think of the witch trials and
great
in the Middle Ages.
The witch trials are a great example of this phenomenon. So we could go on and on, but I think we get the basic idea. The idea being that when we are emotionally gripped and certain, and can't stand or tolerate the existence of another person, probably a good clue that we're hitting an aspect of our own shadow. So the psychological perspective on this and the psychological remedy would then be to take back those projections and try to work with them within the self. That's easily said and very difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. Is there value in us doing that at a personal level, and can it be done at a collective level?
That's a great question. I can say that Jung's perspective on it was that if enough individuals could do this psychological work of dealing with their own shadow, then the world political tensions and conflicts might have a chance of being resolved. But if enough people don't do that work, then we probably are headed for another world war. So Jung's idea was definitely that doing our own psychological work, even on very small levels, day-to-day levels, in interactions with our boss at work or in our relationships with our spouses or with our neighbors, that if we are consciously working on taking back and working with our own shadow, we're doing work of immediate political and social significance, because these are exactly the same types of conflicts that are tearing the world apart.
So how do we balance? So again, I'm thinking about the recent political election and the very, very deep divide between Democrats and Republicans, and I have a lot of liberal friends, and I can hear the demonization of the Republicans as if that would be the worst thing that could ever happen if a Republican had won that election. And then on the other side, Republicans have vilified Barack Obama in, the worst sorts of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot what my question is behind that. Help me out here.
That's a great observation of the phenomenon. I think if we try to step back, as you are doing right now, try to take a step back and see the phenomenon, the political phenomenon in the country, and just observe it, those are the facts. There's half the country voted for Mitt Romney. Half the country voted for Barack Obama. One half, the liberal side of that half is absolutely certain that if Mitt Romney had won, it would be like horrific, and vice versa for the other side. A friend of mine who's a liberal person, I called him up on the night of the election when it was still going on, and he said, "Oh my gosh, I hope the Nazis don't win." You know, that kind of language.
Exactly. Coming from both sides, have used that language.
Coming from both sides. So this is really where we have to take a step back and reflect and not be caught up emotionally in one side or the other being wrong. Because the way the phenomenon works, it's this big split. It's just left and right. Those are symbols, you could say, of conscious and unconscious on both sides.
So I guess I remember what the question was that I was reaching for now, and it was, how does one balance the realization that, okay, I may be engaging in projection and demonization of the other with action? I need to be an activist. I really believe this. Something needs to be done. How does one find the balance point between those two?
You know, yeah, I don't have, I do know what you mean, because this is the in a way, the question about when we talk about psychology and politics, how do they go together? What is the balance point? And I don't have a formula for you or for your listeners,
right.
Or, you know, in terms of that. I think it's an individual issue, and it's a question of one's own individuation process of what one's called to do and how. And different people will have different ways in which they answer that question individually. And some people really are called to be activists and be on the political stage, and other people, you know, not so much. I think the most important thing is to stay in tune with one's own dreams and one's own individuation process slowly and step by step.
Yeah. I guess as I try to imagine my own answer to that question, the key would be not demonizing the other person, but still being passionately engaged, but stopping short of the demonization.
Yeah, I think if you, I think the, this is the word, the phrase that Barbara Hanna, who is a Jungian analyst, had for this was the introversion of war. Taking the conflicts back into oneself. And I've been impressed by certain world leaders that seem to have been able to do this. And because they were adequately able to, say, confront the civil war within themselves or the enemy within themselves and come to grips with that, it seems that they were able to have a healing effect on their environment. For instance, Nelson Mandela is a person that I'm learning more about right now, who seems to have been able to do something like this. And he said over and again that the political activism has to start with the self, and it has to start with one's own conflicts and one's own civil wars.
There was another example that you gave, and I don't know if you'll have it on the tip of your tongue or not, but to the question of what can we do to help the world's problems. In your paper, you had a great quote from Vaclav Havel. I don't know how to. Maybe you can give a little background on him, and if you have the quote at hand, do you? Would you be able to read
that
quote?
Sure. Yeah, I can find it. I have it here. Vaclav Havel. I think is how you pronounce his name. He was the leader of the Czech Revolution, and he was imprisoned multiple times for political dissidents. And he later became the president, the first president of the Czech Republic. He died last year, by the way, at the age of 75, but recognized throughout the world for his many contributions to world peace. When he was in prison, he wrote a series of letters to his wife, and these are published in a book called Letters to Olga. That was his wife's name. And he's asking himself this question, sitting in prison, you know, what can I do about the world problem? It's probably the question that's most pertinent to us. What can I really do, one little person? And his answer is this. He says, if I consider the problem as that which the world is turning me into, that is, as a tiny screw in a giant machine deprived of human identity, then there is really nothing I can do. Obviously, I cannot put a stop to the destruction of the globe, the growing stupidity of nations, and the production of thousands of new thermonuclear bombs. If, however, I consider it as that which each of us originally is, or rather what each of us, irrespective of the state of the world, has the basic potential to become, which is to say, an autonomous human being capable of acting responsibly to and for the world, then, of course, there's a great deal I can do. You can see the his response basically is to make a contribution to the world problem, one has to become one's own task first. This was really Jung's idea too, with his idea of individuation. Not a lot of people are aware that Jung viewed the individuation process as ultimately having a social goal or telos. Jung thought the person who's going through individuation has to first separate out from being identified with the collective group. A process of separation takes place, and that feels like a death of one's own values, a death of one's identification with collective norms and social mores, in a way, in favor of looking within and finding one's own path through life. Jung thought that was the way that new values are created in the culture by individuals that go through that process, who can then offer back the fruits of their own individual journey to the collective. And this is the way the collective gets recycled, in a way. It gets its values rejuvenated by people going through this inner process of death and rebirth themselves and offering something back to the collective world from it.
Well, that's really well put. What's the relationship between war and the ability to withstand the tension of the opposites? Now, that's part of this individuation process from a Jungian point of view, this idea of the tension of the opposites. How does that relate to war?
War is that tension of the opposites happening on a vast collective scale. If enough people split, then war results. I mean, if you just think of the Protestants and Catholics in Ireland, or different sects of Islam, if you think of the axis of evil ideas that we talked about before, if enough people on both sides of the problem are splitting their shadows off and getting emotionally constellated and seeing the enemy out there, that's war. That's mm-hmm. That's one of the things that contributes to war, certainly from the psychological perspective. The idea would be if enough people can introvert or take back within themselves that conflict, it would have a collective effect.
I like the quote that you attributed to Murray Stein about letting go of one's most cherished cultural certainties and dearly held convictions. And so I guess that would be part of this individuation process and maybe this holding the tension of the opposites.
Yeah, and that's, you know, these are, it's easy to say to let go of one's cherished convictions and deep, most deeply held values. This is almost impossible to do. I think it's one of the reasons Jung said that we're headed for mass genocide in the world, another world war, unless we can find a way of salvation through a symbolic death. Because to go through this process of individuation and confront one's own shadow, it's a death. This is a descent to the underworld. It's the death of the old self, the old certainties. It's a huge subject in and of itself, the phenomenology of what that looks like. And it reminds me of that G.K. Chesterton had a quote about Christianity that went to something along the lines of saying that it's not that the Christian ideal has been found, tried and been found wanting, it's been found difficult and left untried. And I think of that all the time with this problem of taking back the shadow, because if you really do that, you're confronted with your opposite. It's a horrific event. It's an event that can lead to despair. It's very difficult to contain and hold the emotional reactions, one's split off wounds, everything one's been defending against and through projection. To really confront those within oneself is a huge opus.
Yes. Now, you earlier in your response there, you used the word symbolic, and you suggest that we need to engage in symbolic thinking as a way out of this mess. What is it that you're getting at? How do we engage in symbolic thinking as opposed to what? Literal thinking?
Right, yeah, as opposed to literal thinking. Why would that be? See, this is a question that needs some context and needs to be addressed, because it's not immediately evident how developing the capacity to think symbolically or metaphorically could have any social relevance at all, as distinct from literally. But if you look at this from the perspective of fundamentalism, it may become a little more apparent what the relevance of developing that capacity could be. Mm-hmm. Fundamentalism is a problem that's having immediate political effects, obviously, in our world, fundamentalisms of all kinds. Fundamentalists think of what psychologists would call archetypal images as being true. Their version is true. They think literally and concretely about religious imagery, and they'll kill you if you have a different image or if you doubt the truth of their image. So from the psychological perspective, fundamentalism takes archetypal images that in themselves are not good or bad or delusional or anything, and by taking them literally, they become dangerous. So if you think of, for instance, take the problem of what, from the perspective of the United States, is Islamic terrorism. From the perspective of the people that engage in those acts and the people that support them, they aren't terrorists at all. They're martyrs. They're engaged in a sacred activity. Ahmadinejad asked, for instance, once, is there an art that is more beautiful, more divine, more eternal than the art of the martyr's death? Right? And the idea is that by blowing oneself up in a fiery inferno, one is not a criminal or seeking one's personal gain, but is engaging in an act of God. This is the idea of sacrifice and the idea of death and rebirth enacted literally. I think that's why it's dangerous.
And we have our own version of that. Yesterday was Veterans Day, and in our neighboring community here of Petaluma, there was a big parade and so on, and a lot of honoring of veterans and the sacrifice that they made for, quotes, God and country.
That's right, yeah. Yes, this motif of sacrifice is a religious term, really. And so it generates huge emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we're not looking at it now as is that right or wrong. We're just trying to observe the phenomenon psychologically and point out that there are religious overtones to those words, mm-hmm. and that those carry big, deep, deep emotional values. And also another thing is to point out that those deep religious emotional values get concretely enacted in terms of war and country. So I think this is what Jung was trying to get at when he said that we're going to be headed for mass genocide unless we can work out the way of salvation through a symbolic death. A death is in the cards in a way. Is it going to be an inner symbolic one or an outer enacted one?
Mm-hmm.
The way into this for me has always been through the poets in our culture who, in a way, are the experts in thinking symbolically. Goethe, for instance, has a poem called The Holy Longing, and I'll read you a little bit about that from that poem, and think about this in the context of martyrdom.
Okay.
Goethe's poem, The Holy Longing, just a little bit of it. Tell a wise person, or else keep silent, for the mass man will mock it right away. I praise what is truly alive and what longs to be burned to death. He sounds a lot like Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, right.
Right? But then he goes on, and at the end of his poem he says, and so long as you have not experienced this, to die and so to grow, you are only a troubled guest on a dark earth. See, so the poet has taken the same archetypal phenomenon as the martyr, and instead of becoming a terrorist or instead of literally enacting it, he's engaged in seeing it symbolically as a process of death and rebirth that can happen in this life now, an inner process. And for that reason, the poet is not a fundamentalist, and he's not a terrorist. The madness of fundamentalism is that it transforms the outer reality into a symbolic reality, but it does this without conscious understanding intention, meaning, or purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Same phenomenon. I think it's very hard in our culture today, as I look around, you know, and listen to the radio and watch movies, there seems to be basically two points of view in our culture. One is literal fundamentalism. These are religious people who think that their archetypal images are true and literally real. And then on the other hand, people like Bill Maher, remember his movie Religulous?
Yes.
making fun of those types of people,
yeah.
Showing them, basically saying, these people are deluded. They're just believing a bunch of lies. They're delusional. And more, they're dangerous because of these delusions are destroying our world. So the psychological point of view, the ability to think symbolically, would be a third perspective in between the either ors of literal truth or delusions. Religious truths are metaphors and symbols. And it seems that the Sufis and poets and people that can see archetypal imagery as symbolic don't become violent people.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've quoted a few other people here. I want to quote you. I liked some of the lines that you wrote in the paper that I was reading. And one that I especially liked, you write, "There is a wild chaos in the human psyche, even an urge to destruction. Freud called it thanatos, or the death instinct, which is exacerbated through a naive, one-sided belief in rational enlightenment, benevolent preaching, and goodwill." Mm. Yeah, close quote. I really like that. And then on that goodwill theme, you also say, if peace could be attained by benevolently preaching enlightened philosophical ideals to others, we would have attained it long ago. Well, yeah. I like both of those a lot.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, go ahead, Doctor.
I wanted to underscore that failure of the failure of rational enlightenment, benevolent preaching, and goodwill, because, you know, I feel like I'm a person of goodwill. So I need you to expand on that a little bit.
Yeah. This, for me, is, what you just quoted from me, it's really influences coming from Switzerland and my training in Switzerland. You know, and Jung lived through two world wars, and Europeans lived through world wars. And being an American and having traveled to Europe, and I realized very much, you know, American optimism and naivete that I had that the Europeans I met didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in part it has to do with their living through on their own soil these world wars and feeling the reality of what human beings can do to human beings. This is Rodney King at the 1992 LA riots asking, why can't we all get along? I think of Neville Chamberlain, you know, who was famously quoted as announcing peace in our time, the British Prime Minister before Churchill, who had met with Hitler in the 30s, and he came back to England and basically said, I've met with Hitler. He signed these treaties saying that we, our two countries, intend not to go to war together ever again, and we will now have peace in our time. And I encourage everyone to now go to their beds and sleep quietly tonight. This lack of imagination for evil, I think, also is it's ultimately destructive. So we get it quickly into the realm, again, of psychology and this idea of shadow, namely that all of us have a shadow. Jung would say often that I'm a human being, I'm capable of everything else any human being has ever done. And Freud thought of this as an instinct in us that he called thanatos, as to think from eros, or the life instinct, the urge to destruction. It's a sobering concept or idea to ponder over, I think, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? Without a clear solution, really, to what to do about it.
One of the things that you talk about is the relevance of collective dreams. We talked about Jung's dreams. What are some examples of collective dreams?
Well, collective dreams would be the types of dreams that any of us can have that at least seem not to have only a personal significance, to not be about our personal lives or issues in our day-to-day existence, but seem to touch upon issues that involve lots of people, ecological issues, issues of war, issues of the apocalypse or overpopulation, or what you can call the archetypal dimension of the collective unconscious, something not personal only to me.
So Jung's dreams that you started with would be examples of that. At first, he took them at a personal level, and he thought, oh my goodness, this means I'm going crazy. But in fact, it foreshadowed the fact that the world was going crazy and was going into this time of war. But others of us, as you point out, can have dreams that touch upon collective world stage kinds of issues. And in fact, you shared a dream around the time of 9/11. Maybe you could share that here.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Yeah, I had a dream that for me was an example of a collective dream, a dream that arose in response to 9/11. I had it about 10 days after that event. And at the time I was in Switzerland training as an analyst, and you know, we all remember what that was like. It was just the feeling of the world is completely different, you know, just a complete shock and the emotions of that, wondering what can I do. I was very concerned with the question of what can I do about this?
Yeah, particularly given that you were, you know, you were off in another country, and I can imagine how disturbing that would be.
That's exactly right. Yeah, off in another country. I'm away from my family and friends and Americans, and feeling very much uprooted as an American over in Europe, you know. And
is this the outbreak of war? Will I be able to get back? Those must have gone through your mind as well.
Yeah, all sorts of things like that. Huge unknown. Just everything was unknown. It seemed like the world had just was different. What had happened was inconceivable. You know, so I was thinking about that. I mean, thinking is too light of a word. I was really ruminating and just kind of obsessed with what should I do? Should I look at the television a lot? Should I try to figure out what's going on? Should I not do any of that? What's my role now as a person? What can I contribute as a little tiny individual to this? And then I had a dream about 10 days after 9/11, and I'll share with you a part of that dream. It was long, but the main part of it was that in the dream there was an Afghan man and a United States man. And I was there with a group of people, and I was watching them, and they were fighting. They were in a conflict fighting each other. And I was in the dream, I was thinking, I have to do something to resolve this conflict or to help with it. I have to do something about it. And then as the dream went on, it took on a strange, dark, and for me, bewildering turn of events. What I had to do to help this conflict was, according to the dream, I had to go through this ritual where I took a knife and cut the palm of my right hand, and I put my own blood into this vessel, this chalice, and then I had to drink my own blood. And the dream said that would be, you know, the ritual you have to go through to do something about this conflict. Now, in the dream, I was able to cut my hand and put the blood in the vessel, but I couldn't drink my own blood. It was just too much. It was too bizarre, too weird, too overwhelming, and strange. And it took me a long time to even work with this dream. And there's so much, of course, we could say about it, and so much I've thought about it and compared it to Jung's ideas and Mysterium Conjunctionis that relate to alchemy and similar images that relate to alchemical ideas. But the main gist of this dream for me was that if I want to do something to help with the world problem, I have to start by extracting, becoming conscious of, and then reintegrating something about my own body, my own fiery blood, my own emotional impulses.
Mm.
And that would be the way that I could help with this problem.
Yeah, we talk about eating one's shadow, eating your shadow. And this feels like, you know, that's part of what you're describing.
Mm. Thank you. Yeah, that's a metaphor that in psychology we talk about, don't we, eating one's own shadow.
Yes.
It's the metaphor for integration, you know, extraction, becoming aware of, and then reintegrating. So it's eating oneself, drinking oneself, becoming one's own problem. The source of the conflict lies within my own blood, my own body. That's what the dream was saying.
And, you know, in the dream you had this urgency to do something, and it occurs to me that you are doing something right now by calling our attention to think symbolically about these issues and to be on the path of individuation and differentiating ourselves from the collective madness and the projection.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that is why I give talks about this subject, and I'm going to be writing more about it and talking with you about it. My conscious intention there is to try to reoffer the collective something about my own inner journey and what I have experienced there, and offer that back.
Yeah, well, good. And I'll look forward to any future conversations about that. As we begin to wind down, I wonder if there are any other points that you'd like to make now or that you had hoped to make here that maybe didn't get brought out.
This is a whole other subject for another day, but strangely, how alchemy and alchemical symbolism and processes relate to world problems. Because the alchemical process, many people think of alchemy, and I know you've talked with Monica Wickman and others about alchemy, Jeff Rath. So, you know, we know that alchemy is to be thought of metaphorically and symbolically, and what it really is all about is what we've been talking about today. These alchemists were people that turned towards what was banished, repressed, marginalized in their cultures, the shadow in their culture, and that's what they called the blackness of the Negredo. They engaged in these processes of symbolic death and renewal, the renewal of values within themselves. And so alchemical symbolism actually has, I think, quite a lot to contribute as a phenomenology of what it looks like to go through a symbolic death.
Well, I think that could be an excellent topic for us to explore in greater depth in the future, if that's something that you're up for. And I wonder if mentioning the dream project that you're doing at Pacifica, if you are inviting listeners to contribute any collective-type dreams that they might have. Is that part of why you mentioned that? Just now?
That would be excellent. And, you know, as I said, it's just getting going now. So if your listeners are interested in learning more about this project, they can certainly email me at, and I'll give you my email address at Pacifica, which is T. Elsner, T-E-L-S-N-E-R, at pacifica.edu. And if you just put collective dreams on the subject heading, I can get back to you. And if there's an interest, that's great. I mean, we are interested in collecting these dreams and really listening into the world soul and its response.
So just to help people with that, say again what might be considered a collective dream. How will people know if they've had a collective dream?
A collective dream could be a dream that you just wake up from. It's a big dream. You know, they typically are shocking. They don't seem personal. You wonder, where the hell did this come from? It's strange and archetypal. You don't have personal associations to the imagery. And you might feel like this is something about the world. I mean, it's something about war. It's something about the ecology. It's something about population problems or, you know, or whatever it might be. But something big seems bigger than your personal life, that would be probably a collective dream.
Okay. Well, that's probably a good place for us to wrap it up for today. So, Dr. Tom Elsner, I want to thank you for being my guest again, and hopefully in the future, on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. Thank you very much.
It was great to have Tom Elsner back on the show. I hope you agree. I've never particularly associated Jung with the political context, but it's clear that the recently published Red Book reveals the degree to which his thinking was impacted by the advent of the First World War and later the Second World War as well. Immediately after the interview with Tom Elsner was over, I realized I'd forgotten to ask a question that was triggered for me by reading his paper. My question concerned synchronicity as another way the collective unconscious comments on global events. I wanted him to expand on that. I do plan to take him up on his offer to come back sometime in the future and speak about alchemy, and hopefully I'll remember to ask him that question about synchronicity and world events at that time. As I say, that question was triggered by the paper he sent me, which was based on a presentation he gave elsewhere. After the interview, I contacted him to see if he'd be willing to let me post a copy of that paper on the Shrink Wrap Radio website for you all to have access to. And he generously and enthusiastically agreed. So you can download the paper in PDF format by going to www.shrinkwrapradio.com/jungandpolitics.pdf. Now, Jung and Politics is all lowercase and one word. And I'll also put a link to it in the show notes on the Shrink Wrap Radio site.
Got the Dr. Dave habit? Need a fix? Just follow these three easy steps to your podcast high. Step one, log on to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click on the big green donate button. Step two, choose the PayPal or credit card option. Step three, click on the contribution amount that best suits your level of need, like Ultra Colossal at $35 a month. If you're really strung out and download each new episode the minute it's posted and then listen to it several times. Super Colossal at $30 a month if you've got a serious Shrink Wrap Jones. Jumbo at $10 a month if you're a recreational listener. Large at $5 if you're in denial and think you can quit listening at any time. Or generous if you know you're not hooked and just enjoy expanding your mind. Ah, now doesn't that feel better? I thank you, and Dr. Dave thanks you.
As I record this, it's Thanksgiving week here in the United States, and I do thank my sister Sherry for that heartfelt promo, and I thank all of you for your support, both past and future. I'm grateful to have so many of you listeners around the world, and for the wonderfully supportive emails that you send me that keep me fired up. I'm also grateful to all my interview guests who allow us to step into their worlds. I feel so privileged and thankful to get the opportunity to dialogue with such accomplished and distinguished guests as you hear on this series. I'm also grateful for the mutual support of my new strategic partners, the Depth Psychology Alliance and the Jung Platform, about whom you can read on our site. And of course, I'm also grateful for the love and health of my family. There's so much to be grateful for, and all the evidence suggests that gratitude is good for our health and longevity. So be sure to do lots of it in this season, and always. Sure, there's lots going on in the world that's distressing, and I don't deny that. I think I'd like to share a poem that my friend and former guest, Larry Robinson, sent me. It's titled, Any Morning, and it's by William Stafford, and it goes like this. Just lying on the couch and being happy, only humming a little, the quiet sound in the head. Trouble is busy elsewhere at the moment. It has so much to do in the world. People who might judge are mostly asleep. They can't monitor you all the time, and sometimes they forget. When dawn flows over the hedge, you can get up and act busy. Little corners like this, pieces of heaven left lying around, can be picked up and saved. People won't even see that you have them. They are so light and easy to hide. Later in the day, you can act like the others. You can shake your head. You can frown. And again, that's by William Stafford. And somehow that poem seems to strike just the right note for me this season. My friend Larry Robinson has the wonderful practice of sending out a poem every day. After including this one here, I realized that it's somewhat synchronistic that my interview with Larry Robinson sometime way back was also about psychology and politics, just as today's was. I got an email from listener Gary Graham asking about the fact that the last episode had not yet shown up in iTunes, even though it was several days after I had announced it on Facebook and Google+. So this rekindled my quandary about my feed and the relationship between it and Mevio. I've previously discussed that Mevio is an advertising company, a podcast advertising company, that I'd previously been associated with but have not been promoting them or their ads for some time. However, when you go to iTunes, you'll see that Shrinkwrap Radio is listed under their site there, which is something I've been trying to change but with no luck. In the past, whenever I put up a new episode, I've always had to post it to two places. One is to my Shrinkwrap Radio website page so that you'll see it when you go to shrinkwrapradio.com, and the other was to the Mevio server. I've been trying to figure out whether I still need to post to the Mevio server because that's an extra step and extra work. And this has been particularly difficult to figure out, especially in as much as Mevio, as such, has closed down. There's nobody there for me to speak to or to complain to or to ask questions of. You may have noticed that I sent out another test feed message, and that was to see if by posting it only to my website, would it also appear on iTunes. And since it did appear on iTunes, that would suggest that I only need to post to my website. But as Gary Graham pointed out, it seems to be taking a long time for things to show up on iTunes when it's not just a short test feed, but a full-length show. So I was trying to wait it out when I got that message from Gary, and I panicked, and so I posted it to Mevio, and the show came up the very next day in iTunes. So now I still don't know if it needed that extra nudge of my posting it to Mevio or not. Here's the thing. I usually post these shows on Friday or Saturday morning, but I'm discovering that they may not show up on iTunes until the following Wednesday. Now, you would be able to listen right away on Friday or Saturday if you go to the Shrinkwrap Radio website, but if the place where you subscribe to the show is dependent on iTunes, it may take longer. I'm guessing that what might be going on is that tons of other podcasters also post on Friday and Saturday, and maybe there's just a huge line that I'm in. So for this particular podcast that I'm working on today, the one that you're listening to right now, despite the fact that it's Thanksgiving week, I'm really pushing to get it out this Friday morning or Saturday latest. And I'm going to try to have the strength of character and the resolve not to post it to Mevio and wait until it appears on iTunes unless something like a full week goes by without it appearing. So let's see what happens. And if you can't stand the tension, just go to the site and download it from there. Don't forget that I've just put up a new 7-unit CE or continuing education course on Jungian psychotherapy. It's the 5th such course, and if you take all 5 courses for 33 units, you can also get a discounted price and earn a certificate of completion. Just go to the Stores tab on the Shrinkwrap Radio site for full details. I'm afraid there's still no new transcripts to announce. If you have volunteered to do a transcript, please let me know what progress you are making, or if you've decided to abandon it. And if you are interested in volunteering to be a transcriber for one or more interviews, please let me know.
Hello, this is Robert Bosnack, Jungian analyst and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, our next guest will be Jungian analyst Robert Bosnack. More about that in a bit. First, let's dig into some recent emails from our listener community. For starters, we hear from Mary in Melbourne, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I just wanted to say hello from Melbourne, Australia, and let you know how much I value your podcasts on a professional level and a personal level. I'm a psychologist who works with traumatized children using play therapy and sand play therapy as my primary modalities. I have a depth psychology orientation. This, believe it or not, makes me very unusual in the psychology field here in Australia, where the primary modes of practicing seem to be oriented around CBT, ACT, DBT, or perhaps narrative therapy. I'm the only psychologist I know who uses words such as soul, psyche, archetypal, the feminine, synchronicity, etc. I feel very isolated professionally and take solace that I am not alone by listening to your inspiring guests and your wonderful interviews. Personally, I am also the only psychologist I know, or who is willing to admit out loud, that I'm in analysis. Once again, this puts me in completely foreign soil in the psychology world here, as I've never heard any other psychologist make reference to the importance of personal work. I have been a counselor for 10 years, and finally I feel I belong to a professional psychological virtual family because of your podcasts. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart for your generosity in offering this program to us listeners, bringing us together from wherever we are in the world. In gratitude," and that's from Mary. Mary, thank you so much for sharing that. And it's really shocking that you are so alone there. And I know I have many listeners in Australia, and I think I have some in Melbourne as well. And so if you're a depth-oriented person, why don't you post something in our comments area reassuring to Mary, letting her know that she's not alone there in Australia. For example, listener Peter B. Todd, who's written a depth-oriented book just recently, I know is involved in depth-oriented psychotherapy. I think he's in Sydney, though, rather than Melbourne. So I'm sure there are other fellow spirits out there for you, Mary. Next, we hear from Ida in Turkey. She's written before, and now she writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave, how are you? We have returned home from our trip to the USA. We had a great time, and I could download much of the interviews." The interview that she had trouble downloading Shrink Wrap Radio in Turkey, and so she's referring to being able to download some of the interviews while she was in the U.S. The interview that you made with Tom Elsner was really fascinating for me about fairy tales. I have listened to it many times. I'm interested in fairy tales and reading a lot myself because I'm writing a book for children nowadays. While I was listening, you said in the interview that sometimes a fairy tale affects us and it has important implications for our life. Here I want to share something about it with you. I thought to myself that Heidi, a book of Johanna Spyri, had a great impact on me when I was a small child. The characters there quite match with my family, with my father, Heidi's grandfather, my mother, Miss Rottenmeier, and my sister, Clara. Even my husband appeared later on as Peter. When I came to my 20s, I found that there was a reality that was lacking in the story but existed in my life that I have never accepted as true in the real sense. Maybe because of that, the story was very appealing for me. It was this, that Miss Rottenmeier and Heidi's grandfather were, quotes, married. Now I have a nice family for my own with Peter. But I sometimes feel those shadows around me about my parents. I don't know how it can be interpreted from a Jungian point of view, but in terms of anima or animus, maybe you can help me at this point with a little advice. I still carry that little child in me, unattended, ignored, excluded sometimes, though I have a good family myself. All the best, Ida. Well, I wrote back to Ida, and I suggested that it would be difficult for me or for Tom Elsner to offer very much in the way of advice. I didn't totally follow what Ida was saying, but I did go on to suggest that she try dialoguing with the characters in Heidi that were important to her, but especially to dialogue in a journal with quotes that little child that you refer to who is unattended, ignored, excluded. In other words, her inner child. And I suggested that it's not enough to just do a kind of a one-time dialogue, but to really have it be an ongoing dialogue over time to give that inner child a voice, as well as maybe some of the other characters with some back and forth. And I think some insights might emerge from that. So, Ida, I hope you're listening and that you'll keep me posted. I hope you can get this, actually, in Turkey. Here's one last one that reads as follows. Dr. Dave, I love Shrink Wrap Radio. Do you know approximately when you'll be interviewing Dr. Panksepp? I just got his book, and it is fascinating. Will there be a charge for listening? Thank you, Dr. Simone Ravitz. Dr. Simone, well, it just so happens that that will be my very next interview, and I'll say more about that in just a moment. And no, there is no charge for listening to any of this rich mix of interviews, but a financial donation would always be greatly appreciated. So I think that better wrap it up for now. And as always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where my name is ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Jungian analyst Dr. Tom Elsner, for sharing his insights on Jung and politics. And by the way, Dr. Elsner will be conducting a 4-month intensive on alchemy, the Red Book, and the new myth of our time. You can find full details at www.pacifica.edu/alchemy, which is all lowercase, and then Elsner, which starts with a capital E, .html. And by the way, there will be a link to that in the show notes on our site. So if you didn't quite catch it, that's a good way to get to it. I just realized I misspoke in replying to Dr. Ravitz that my interview with Jaak Panksepp would be the next one. Actually, that one's about 2 weeks away. As I mentioned earlier, my next one will be with Jungian analyst Dr. Robert Bosnak, and he'll be taking us through some of the initial highlights of a 30-hour course that he'll be offering on Jung's Red Book. I think you'll find that very interesting, especially all you fans of C.G. Jung. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.